Well, like he said, my name is Traver Ginrich. I'm the pastor at Grace Chapel Reformed Baptist Church, about 15 minutes northeast of Birmingham. We're only about 20 minutes from Kurtz Church. We're glad to have them as another Reformed Baptist church in the area. We're a 1689 confessional Reformed Baptist church, just like many of you here. I have way too much material. I'll admit that. I'm just going to go as far as I can in my first lecture. I am very honored to be here. Thank you, Mark, for inviting me. Church history has always been one of my favorite subjects, especially when it comes to the Puritans and the early particular Baptists, neither of which I get to talk about today, because the title of my lecture is The Anabaptists, The Junk Drawer of the Reformation. I am equally as fervorous about them as well. I know that title initially sounds pejorative, but I think as I explain what it means, you'll see that it's not meant derogatorily. So my task today and tomorrow is to cover the Anabaptist, in whom I happen to have a vested interest because, as Mark said, one of the reasons he asked me to handle them is because I was born, raised in, and was a voluntary member of an Anabaptist church up until the age of 28. And like any other peculiar group, there's no better education about them than having lived among them and been one by conviction. The best known Anabaptist groups in America today are the Mennonites, the Amish, and the Hutterites. I was not a part of any of those. I was part of what was called the Apostolic Christian Church. I don't want to spend too much time telling stories about what my church life was like. I could go on and on about that, but I do want to describe a few things so that you get a glimpse of what the experience was like, at least in my sect. All the church leaders were laymen. They were distinctly against any kind of training from the outside or even internally. In fact, when a minister got up to preach, he might not even know he was preaching that morning, but he simply would open the Bible at random, and whatever his eyes first fell upon would be his text. So every sermon's text is completely unplanned, and its content is extemporaneously preached. It's to be under the influence of the Holy Spirit. It's kind of mystical that way. The men and women would sit on separate sides of the congregation. There's no jewelry allowed, not even wedding rings, though that is somewhat changing in a few churches as of very recently. The men would wear dark suits with a white shirt and a dark tie. The ties were always a must. I once was visited in my home by a brother who admonished me because my thrift store suits were not conforming enough to what was expected. The women would always wear their hair up, usually in a bun. They wear head coverings, a smaller one for daily use, and then kind of a bigger, longer one for the church service. Facial hair and sports were banned outright. If you did either one, you couldn't be baptized. Again, that facial hair aspect is starting to change in a few churches. Marriage is said to be by faith, which meant no dating at all. Marriage proposals were actually submitted through the elders, so I would call my elder who called her and asked her if she was willing to receive a proposal for consideration, and then that answer was given in reverse. She'd call her elder who called my elder who called me, so I got a call from my elder informing me that I was getting married. My wife and I did not date before getting married, and we paid all the expected consequences of that, but that's another story for another day. Some would get engaged, this doesn't happen as often, but some would get engaged after a single 15-minute conversation. Some weren't even sure of the name of the person, or they would get the name, they wouldn't, I don't know who that is, and they'd have to find out, and they'd marry him when they got that proposal. But they generally marry young. Marriage itself is very highly esteemed in the culture. If you were 25 and single, something had gone wrong, you were over the hill. Engagements are very short, usually about 3 months. Weddings are large. We had, I think, 1,500 people at our wedding. Greeting with a holy kiss is still practiced. Only men with men and women with women. So every time you see someone in church or if you go to their home, you would say greetings and you would kiss them on the lips. At my extended family get-togethers, all my uncles, you'll see them shake hands. They'll say greetings or farewell, whichever, and they would they kiss, and they still do this. Please never quote me on this out of context, but I have literally kissed hundreds of men. Their church discipline is perhaps their grossest abuse. If you know about the Anabaptists historically, this probably won't surprise you. Excommunication is practiced with the ban, or what's called shunning. the ban, where the person that is excommunicated, nobody's allowed to even eat with them. And sadly, excommunication is exercised even if the person is voluntarily coming in confession and repentance for the sin. It's still, they're excommunicated to keep the church pure of sorts. They generally save it for serious sins, but restoration to fellowship and membership is, it was always very, very rare. They would automatically remove your membership if you married anyone that was not a member of the church, so you weren't allowed to do that. Communion was practiced once a year, and it was forbidden to be taken in any other church. In my wife's church growing up, they did not have communion for years on end at all because one of the other church members, and I think there was about 10 or 12 people that went there, one of the other church members was upset that my now mother-in-law had bangs and their family had a TV down in their basement. So because of that discord, there was no communion for years. Anabaptists have historically been against most new forms of technology. You see that in the Amish and the older Mennonites. In my church, it was never banned outright, but it was discouraged. It could be preached against. You would be looked down upon if you had too much of it. You weren't allowed to serve in the church if you had some technologies in your home. Ministers would never have TVs. It was extremely rare. Many don't have the internet. Many still don't have TVs. Some of them do now. Phones were, when they first came about, they were against phones. And I don't mean cell phones. I mean literally telephones that were on your wall in your house. I remember in my grandparents' farmhouse, I used to always go play with their old rotary hand crank. You know, you hold it to your ear and talk into the... They still had that on their wall. They had an updated rotary phone, but that was still up on their wall. When cars were becoming widespread, they were against them. They were even in the past against their members using lightning rods on their houses because they thought it displayed a lack of faith. I could go on and on. My old church, like some other, many other Anabaptist sects, has not been able to totally avoid the influence of the modern age and American evangelicalism, though they have tried to shield their members from both of those. So some of those more ridiculous items I've just listed have begun to fade in some of the local churches, but that has been in recent years. I'm sure actually some of them will watch this or see it online, and I admit some of them have changed a bit, but this was what it was like when I was growing up in it. In a way, I will say I am appreciative of my upbringing. It's made me far more appreciative of biblical doctrine and biblical church polity, and especially of the gospel. It's sort of like a man who's lost in the desert comes out and he's way more appreciative of drinking fountains and indoor plumbing. They do not take that for granted anymore. And that's sort of the way I feel, because, you know, a man in the desert goes without it for so long. Now, if upon a hearing that list, significant portions of it do not align with what you know about Anabaptists, then don't be surprised. For us, for instance, facial hair was banned. Even stubble was seen as being rebellious. Amish, on the other hand, have traditionally required facial hair, without mustaches, but facial hair, at least of their married men. So there's this fascinating intersection of the cultures between Anabaptists and Eastern European immigration in the late 19th and early 20th century, and it influenced their perspectives on the acceptability of mustaches because of the association with the military over in Europe and that conflicting with the Anabaptist doctrine of pacifism. Very fascinating stuff, but we don't have time for that. But here's the point that I was getting at, contrasting my upbringing with the Amish regarding facial hair. Each Anabaptist group tends to have their own set of idiosyncratic traditions. There are similarities, but the real unifying characteristic across Anabaptist groups is not identical traditions and practice. It's idiosyncratic traditionalism. That is the first characteristic of what it means to be Anabaptist. If you're taking notes, I'll try and highlight the things that are worth writing down. Idiosyncratic traditionalism is a strong characteristic of Anabaptists. There are odd practices among each group without much connection to either the Catholic, the universal church, or even to Scripture itself. But whatever it is that they develop, whatever idiosyncratic tradition they invent, they will hold to it with a tenacity to the point where to do otherwise is considered rebellion against church authority. They are very Pharisaical this way. Many Anabaptist churches are drowning their people in Phariseeism. The traditions they make up get elevated to the same level as God's law, and they are enforced by the leaders of the church as if they are equal to God's law. And rebellion against the teaching authority of the church is a significant taboo. Doing so is usually a sign that you've lost your salvation, or you're not saved, which that's another defining characteristic of Anabaptism. The surety that salvation can be lost. That is a characteristic of Anabaptism. The surety that salvation can be lost. I'll talk more about their doctrine probably tomorrow, but they are fiercely Arminian. They never abandoned late medieval, synergistic, semi-Pelagian soteriology. They wouldn't use the Arminian label for themselves. Arminians rarely do, but they would heartily agree with all 5 points of Arminianism. And the one point that they would hold to the strongest and care the most about is definitely that you can lose your salvation. That is it for them. In fact, if anyone holds to the doctrine of the perseverance of the saints, they think that they're a Calvinist. So even those one-pointer traditionalist Southern Baptists are Calvinists to them. They would hate that idea, but in the Anabaptist mind, they're Calvinists. And the Anabaptists generally see that doctrine at the root of evangelicalism's error. They would see it as the big reason that churches are so weak today. They perceive it all as easy believism and carnal Christianity stemming from the fact that everybody's out there thinking that they can't lose their salvation so they can do whatever they want. The odd thing is their pervasive Arminianism is why you see traditionalist Southern Baptists attempting to find unity with the Anabaptists in history rather than the genuine Baptist roots among the Puritans and the founders of the SBC who were blatantly Calvinistic, as we even heard of the Georgia Baptists. Now, before I go on into the real heart of this lecture, I want to sort of describe what I'm trying to convey. I don't just want to give a historical rundown of significant figures and events, though some of that needs to be included, and we'll go over it, because that shapes their history, and their history has shaped their modern iterations. But anybody can read those in detail on their own. I want to do more analysis and diagnosis along with that historical rundown. I'll tell you now that nearly everything that I say, both good and bad, can be fairly responded with, well, not all Anabaptists, which is true, but we have to speak in general themes. And I have to constantly say, some Anabaptists were this way, and I'll try and distinguish wherever I can. What I hope to leave you with is an understanding of the Anabaptist ethos, to get a feel of the spirit of the Anabaptists, what they are like, to have a feel for Anabaptism as a movement. Because no two groups of them are the same. But there are similar teachings and mentalities and tendencies and characteristics, some of which I've already described, and you'll see those across Anabaptist groups. But we will start today with a bit of history, and that goes back to their arrival on the scene during the Reformation. That's where my title comes in, of the Anabaptists, the junk drawer of the Reformation. And that initially sounds pejorative. I'm not calling them junk. It sounds like that, but I am simply acknowledging a historical reality. Everyone has that one drawer in their kitchen or their office that is filled with odds and ends. It's usually really messy. Some of the stuff in it is useful. Some of it is garbage that could easily be thrown out if anyone paid attention to what was in there. It's a hodgepodge of clutter whose only unifying element is that there's no good alternative place to put any of it. So it all gets dumped in that junk drawer. That's what the Anabaptist title was in the 16th century. The category is not as broad now, but back then, most of it just didn't, it was just the ones that didn't fit in any other category, and they were just called the Anabaptists. They definitely weren't Roman Catholic, they weren't Protestant, they weren't Reformed, and they weren't Lutheran. They were just the category for all the miscellaneous sects, radicals, revolutionaries, mystics, spiritualists, apocalyptic preachers, and frankly, lunatics that cropped up in Europe during the confusion that naturally emerged from a rigid and stratified religious socioeconomic world that had been turned on its head by the combined forces of the Reformation and the Renaissance. I apologize for that run-on sentence there, but that's the best definition I can come up with, and I'm going to repeat it slowly. The Anabaptists were just a category for all the miscellaneous sects, radicals, revolutionaries, mystics, spiritualists, apocalyptic preachers, and lunatics that cropped up in Europe during the confusion that naturally emerged from a rigid and stratified religious socioeconomic world that had been turned on its head by the combined forces of the Renaissance and the Reformation. I'm going to try and fill that out a bit. It's a very long definition. If we were to use the term reformers in the broadest sense possible, as in all those that departed the old order of Roman Catholicism in the 16th century, then the Anabaptists were the epitome of reformers who had zeal without knowledge. The Anabaptists are not our spiritual forefathers. So why talk about the Anabaptists at a Baptist Distinctives Conference? After all, as I hope you all know by now, us Baptists did not come from the Anabaptists. There's no organic connection whatsoever. The Baptists came from the particular Baptist Puritans who were separatists from the all-too-slow-to-reform Anglican Church in England under Queen Elizabeth and King James and King Charles I. They developed in the early 1500s until they finally established a distinctly Baptist identity under John Spilsbury and others in the 1530s. They were Puritan, they were Reformed, they were confessional, they were Calvinist, they were covenantal, they were congregational, and they were Credo Baptist. Exactly what we still are right now. The only commonality that the Anabaptists shared with them was the Credo Baptist part. So I say again, the Anabaptists are not our spiritual forefathers. Although, as a persecuted religious minority, as we both were, neither they nor we wanted the state dictating to the church allowable beliefs and practices. But even there, it would not be accurate to say that the Baptists and the Anabaptists shared the same view of the state or the civil realm in general. There's similarities, but they don't share the same view. So again, why talk about them here? Well, in spite of those historical facts about Baptists, we still get lumped together with the Anabaptist. People assume that the Baptist faith was the flower that bloomed from the seed of the Anabaptists, that the Anabaptists sort of disappeared or developed into Baptists. That is not true. The Anabaptists were winnowed or diminished into a more identifiable group. Their most radical factions, theologically, philosophically, civilly, politically, that kind of thing, those most radical factions disappeared, but the Anabaptists never went away. So we talk about them as Baptists so that we know why they are not us and we are not them in doctrine, in practice, or in history. The second reason to talk about them is because some of the characteristics of the Anabaptists have become increasingly evident among modern-day evangelical believers, such as radical independence, especially from the institutional church. People today have far less problem throwing out or at least completely ignoring centuries of historic creeds, confessions, historical theology, and orthopraxy. Churches are trying to reinvent the wheel on statements of faith, on church polity, on the mission of the church, on church membership, on worship, nearly everything. They just sort of get together and make it up. They're detached from history. They're detached from the small C Catholic Church. Because of the dearth of historical confessionism and because of the rampant apostasy of the mainline churches, in some legitimate ways, we could say that the Anabaptists have promulgated their ethos more pervasively into American Christianity than perhaps any other Reformation group. I don't think they did that themselves. They don't have much contact with the evangelical world. But still, evangelicalism has been largely Anabaptized, if we could say that. And lastly, one final reason we talk about the Anabaptists is for the simple fact that they are terribly interesting. And there is no shame in wallowing in the pure enjoyment of church history. And if there were, then my MP3 player would be nearly empty most days. Also, let me acknowledge there is a problem when it comes to studying the Anabaptists that you will see in the sources if you start to look at it. Many historians who spend significant time on them look at the Anabaptists with rose-colored glasses. They are overly favorable because of the persecution against them. So they're underdogs. So they're overly nice to them. They create this unrealistic picture of being overly sympathetic and then glossing over many of the most significant errors, or they just kind of ignore them or pretend like every one of those errors was just an aberration. Other historians simply highlight the craziest of the bunch and then brush past the rest too quickly. They snipe at them, which is admittedly very easy to do. The Anabaptists produced a lot of low-hanging fruit for which to criticize them, but a select few of them are worthy of our respect. Today, we're going to talk about the best of the best. Tomorrow morning, we're going to talk about the worst of the worst. If you are reading something and the Anabaptists come off looking pretty good, then know there's probably a need for harsher judgment. If you are reading something and not one of them seems like a genuine brother in Christ seeking truth, then there's probably a need for more generous analysis. So if you are prompted to read more about them in the future, please be aware of that reality in the secondary sources. I'll try to maintain a proper balance as I deal with them. I feel this innate tug to defend them in weird ways because of my upbringing, yet knowing what I know about their doctrine and practice both today and in the past 500 years, I have a near endless list of harsh criticism and frustrations with them. I'll be honest, I'd say that my punitive posture towards them outweighs my defensive posture, and I think that's justified, as I will try to show you. Now, with all that being said, let's return to the 16th century to get our minds around them even more, around these original Anabaptists. Remember that junk drawer idea. Anabaptists ranged from naive biblicists, again, I don't mean that negatively, just a little bit naive. So it ranged from that to complete and utter kooks, insane people. And it included everything in between. And there's no clear delineations between who's what. There's bleed over all the way across. They could not be fairly called Protestant or Roman Catholic, obviously. And make no mistake, that title, Anabaptist, was a slanderous label. It was meant to fearmonger. We'll talk about why it acquired that reputation probably tomorrow morning. It was almost like calling someone a Branch Davidian. If you know the story of David Koresh and the Branch Davidians in the 90s, or a Jonestownian, somebody from Jonestown, like saying that they drank the Kool-Aid. And this is because of the Munster Rebellion and the Peasants' War and political anarchy that became associated with them. We're going to get to it. By the way, the People's Temple, led by Jim Jones, that eventually culminated in the mass murder and suicide of like 900 people, they claimed that they were practicing apostolic socialism. And they had Marxist leanings. Well, some of the Anabaptist sects likewise practiced forms of apostolic socialism, Christian socialism, and they had these proto-Marxist leanings. They implemented Marxism, more or less, a proto-Marxism, when they got the chance. And one of their stories, the one of Munster, rivals Jonestown in its level of shock and scandal. I'd say it blows Jonestown out of the water. You have to come back tomorrow to hear that. But the Anabaptist socialism and the proto-Marxism that they held to was all claimed to be apostolic. In fact, that desire to be apostolic is one of the defining characteristics as well. They want to be apostolic. They have this mindset of returning to the simplicity of doctrine and life that they perceive in the apostolic era. And in some cases, they want to return to the socialistic communities that they think existed in the early churches, the Amish, are still basically socialistic. The Hutterites are essentially communistic. I've seen videos where the families come in and get their daily food ration from the guy in charge of it. Daily food rations for them. Anabaptists have a golden age perception of the early church. You can see it in that name of the church that I grew up in, Apostolic Christian Church. We're the originals. That's what they're claiming. That's what they're trying to get back to. And you would hear them articulate this idea of a simple faith when it came to arguing against doctrines that they don't agree with. They claim they just want a simple faith. Just a simple faith. And they accuse you of complicating things with overly deep or defined doctrine, which they do not like. at all. I told a guy once that I wanted to get into the doctrinal meat referring to Hebrews. And he says, well, don't you know, if you get into the meat, you might get into the bone. And I didn't know what that meant. He never explained it to me, but I perceived it was supposed to be bad. I have yet to reach the bone that is so detrimental in doctrine. So it's fair to say that Anabaptists are apostolic primitivists. They are trying to recover the primitive church. So that's another characteristic, apostolic primitivist. But that name, Anabaptist, was used slanderously and polemically. If there was a group that was apart from the establishment that someone didn't agree with, they might get called an Anabaptist to try and attack them. When the particular Baptist arose in England, there were pamphlets published against them, calling them Anabaptists, and implying that they would do to England what the Anabaptists had done in Munster. They'll try to overthrow the king and take over England. The Anabaptists had a history of that. So when the particular Baptist wrote their first confession, they titled it The Confession of Faith of Those Churches Which Are Commonly, Though Falsely, Called Anabaptists. Likewise, I think not many people know this. I was talking to Brandon about this morning. The first edition of the Institutes, Calvin had to say that he and the other Reformed, the Huguenots in France, were not Anabaptists. Even he was accused of it. And obviously, that had nothing to do with credo baptism. It had to do with rebellion and anarchy and upsetting the establishment, all of which are glamorized in our modern entertainment culture and on our college campuses, but were both despised and genuinely feared in the Reformation era. So the accusation of Anabaptists was used to incite opposition to some reform-minded groups. The Roman Catholic Church used them as the example of the logical conclusion of the Reformation. They're saying, see, that's what's going to happen. You leave the Roman Catholic Church, you're all going to be there eventually. That's the logical conclusion. The Anabaptists almost ruined the Reformation. It's fair to say that. Medieval Roman Catholic sacramentalism was like heroin. If an addict stops it cold turkey, it can actually be dangerous. It's somewhat counterintuitive, but you have to wean them off of it over time. That's what Europe was like. A heroin addict, except they're addicted to Roman Catholic sacramentalism. Europe was like that with bad religion. Unfortunately, it could not be immediately reformed in every dimension. It couldn't be. Some things just had to take longer. It had to be brought along. They had to be weaned into the truth. The sacraments, for instance, didn't get fully reformed until like 100 years after the 95 Theses. Luther partially reformed the Lord's Supper and baptism and church polity. Got rid of the Pope, got rid of transubstantiation, didn't fully reform it, got rid of elements of baptism that were wrong. The Continental Reformed and Presbyterian came along, they reformed it a little bit more. And the particular Baptist then came in and finished the job. I would argue that the particular Baptist got those three right. Lord's Supper, baptism, church polity. They finally got it fully reformed 100 years after Luther. And their understanding consistently fencing both baptism and the Lord's Supper for believers only, and then considering them both as a means of grace, that consistent fencing became a Baptist distinctive. We treat the Lord's Supper and baptism for believers only, because that's consistent. From Luther to the Reformed Baptist, they got closer and closer to a biblical understanding. This is where I find a bit of sympathy for the Anabaptists. If we're being generous, we might say that they were a little bit ahead of their time. It's a very nice way of saying elements of their teaching were a little bit ahead of their time. But some of what they were demanding, I mean, it was centered on biblical reform, but they wanted it without hesitation, to which they deserve some credit. They wanted religious liberty immediately, and that was just never going to happen that quickly. It wasn't going to happen. They believed in the separation of church and state, but not in the secular sense. They didn't want a secular society. They just wanted liberty for themselves because they were a persecuted minority. They wanted to be left alone. Unfortunately, in isolated pockets where Anabaptists had the majority, they were not so permissive in granting religious freedom themselves. Confessional Presbyterians took a while to abandon their idea of a state church. It wasn't until they saw that sacralism was not going to pass muster in the newly democratic-minded America that they finally abandoned this idea. I know we can find significant flaws like that in every group of reformers, but the Anabaptists are simply more complicated and more flawed. Generally speaking, in my opinion, they are one of the embarrassing aspects of the entire era. Some of them were not as bad as the rest, but overall, they're still trending pretty negative. I saw one historian raise the question. He said, were they heretics, fanatics, saints? And I believe the answer has to be heretics, yes, some of them. Fanatics, yes, some of them. Saints, yes, some of them. And that answer, honestly, has not changed in 500 years, though it's clear that the proportions between those three divisions has changed a little bit. There are less fanatics now. That element did not endure, thankfully. They tended to get themselves killed. Remember, the Anabaptists were not Protestant. They wanted radical change in both a good sense and a bad sense. But in seeking that change, it is helpful to think of them as non-magisterial reformers. They sought no partnership with the secular authority like the princes, the city council, the magistrates. They weren't trying to like use them or their power and say, hey, let's get this done. And that tended to push them to the fringes of society even more. This is a generalization, but the magisterial reformers were thinking in terms of reforming the institutional church and entire nations. The Anabaptists were thinking in terms of reforming each person or each individual church, being allowed to do what they please. Not necessarily because they didn't want large-scale reform, but because they had no confidence in the Christians that they saw in Europe or the reformers or the civil authorities. So they're looking very narrow, very small. The magisterial reformers are looking big, big picture. The Anabaptists had a narrower view focused just on them and their small band of followers. Even though they deserve some credit, we have to acknowledge that many of them were unhinged and detached from historical orthodoxy, so for which they deserve scorn. And because of that detachment, they fell into severe doctrinal error, almost willy-nilly. Or it might be better to say that they never abandoned the error of much of medieval theology, particularly the soteriology. They never actually abandoned that. They just wanted a more holy church to accompany it. I've used this illustration on several occasions, and it seems to help people grasp how this worked. All too often, the Reformation is looked at like it's this linear scale where the Roman Catholic Church is here, and then the Lutherans reformed it a little bit, and then the Continental Reformed made a little bit more progress, and then further down the line, again, away from Roman Catholicism, the Puritans reformed it even more. And I've almost spoken of it in those terms when I talk about it. And to a degree, that's true. And then they think, well, then the Anabaptists came along on this linear scale. They leapfrogged them all. They're all the way over here on the far right, and they made the most radical reform. They're the absolute farthest away from the Roman Catholic Church, and that's how they think of it. That's not accurate. It's more like a horseshoe, like this. It's a horseshoe where, yes, the Lutherans reformed away from Roman Catholicism. They make their way up the horseshoe. And then, yes, the Continental Reform made a little bit more progress. And, yes, the Puritans came along and improved even more. But the Anabaptists actually came back around and actually started mimicking some of the Roman Catholics' same errors. They traveled the furthest in terms of reform, but they didn't always head the right direction. So in the end, they wound up closer to Roman Catholicism than the Reformed or the Puritans, even though they supposedly reformed further. It's like a football player, a running back who runs, sees that he's blocked, and then he runs backwards 10 yards to try and avoid his tacklers and waves and wags, and in the end, he makes it 1 yard past the line of scrimmage. That's what it's kind of like. They weren't the most progressive reformers. They were a bit regressive from their fellow reformers. They paralleled Roman Catholicism in odd ways. They have a similar level of unbiblical, idiosyncratic traditionalism as Roman Catholicism, but without the Pope, without the sacramental system. But both are still inherently Pharisaical. Let me try and explain this. Roman Catholicism created this empty black box. They took this empty black box and they filled it up over time with all kinds of man-made and heretical inventions. Then they got out their label maker and they slapped a nice big label on the front that said tradition. This is our big box of tradition. They didn't seek to defend any of those made-up traditions that are in the box. They just defended the concept of traditions in general. And then they enforced tradition as a concept with this authoritarian power of the church, reinforcing this tradition. So that's, you've got this box of tradition, you've got the power of the church behind it enforcing it all. And then they can add and take away from that box as they please. They can just open up that lid and throw in a little bit of papal infallibility because that's a pretty useful tradition for a church that has power. People seem to like the Virgin Mary, so let's open up that lid. Let's add to that tradition a bit. Let's drop in a set of Marian dogmas. Now that's part of tradition. They never have to show that there's any historical doctrine in the Bible that defends that because it's tradition. And look here in the Bible where it says that tradition is spoken of positively. Look here in the Bible where you see that. So submit to the tradition. Or we'll use the power of the keys to excommunicate you. And oh, by the way, there's no salvation outside the church. So submit. See how this concept of traditions can be twisted to become traditionalism. We have no problem with traditions. We have a problem with traditionalism, authoritarian traditionalism. See how powerful that can be for an authoritarian church. They can do whatever they want. They can create a rule that you have to have pink houses, and they can enforce it by the power of the keys. Well, the Anabaptists came along, and they like that black box, but they don't like what's in it. So they take it to the trash can, and they just dump out that box of traditions. They just dump it out. We want no connection to the institutional church. But this is a pretty nice box. I like this box. They can put anything in this box. And they appear to have a biblical defense for anything that they put in it. Because look at that label. It says tradition. Who could be against tradition? Christianity has tradition. Look where the Bible speaks positively about tradition. So they kept that box and they invented new traditions, idiosyncratic traditions. Now you have to have a beard. Or maybe you cannot have a beard. But suddenly it's law because it's tradition. Or you have to marry in our church only. Or you have to dress this way. No, you can't wear a colored shirt. No, you can't wear jeans to a singing. That's worldly. No, you can't play sports. That leads to pride. No, you can't use modern technology. That's what the world does. No, wedding dresses have to look this way. They have to be this length. You have to pray this way. Use these words. You have to live in our community. You have to wear these kind of dresses. You have to have this view of the civil magistrate. It's tradition. You can't have buttons on your clothes. That's vain adornment. What are you doing? You can't have pictures of yourselves. That's the same as a graven image. What are you doing? And the list goes on, and you have to submit to it because these are our traditions. Look at the label on the box. And don't you see here on the Bible where it talks about tradition? It's positive. It talks about traditions. It's good. You aren't being rebellious, are you? Do the elders need to exercise the power of the keys and excommunicate you? Do you need to get banned from eating with us even? You know there's no salvation outside the church, don't you? Why won't you submit to the traditions? It's fundamentally the same concept of both traditionalism and church authority. It's just got a different mask. Yes, the Anabaptists were less formalized when they mimicked that Roman Catholic air this way, but they never abandoned the medieval air. I remember when I was in one of Dr. James Renahan classes at seminary, and he quoted and adamantly agreed with John Owen's comment that Christian liberty was the second principle of the Reformation. At first glance, the Anabaptists are all about church or Christian liberty. But in the end, they implemented a mutant version of it that ironically paralleled the Roman Catholic Church that they detested so strongly. They are no less dogmatic about their traditions that they've invented ex nihilo than the Roman Catholicism, the Roman Church, is about theirs. They're no less dogmatic. And that has become another defining characteristic of the Anabaptist. Not just any idiosyncratic traditionalism, but authoritarian traditionalism. Authoritarian traditionalism. Their idea of Christian liberty has not been applied to the individual Christian conscience. It was meant by the reformers to restrain church authorities from imposing unbiblical worship practices and man-made laws. The Anabaptists have ignored that restraint and imposed their own version of traditionalism. I think one of the best reasons the early Anabaptists may look unrecognizable in the face of the modern image we have of the Amish or the older order Mennonites, is those traditions took time to develop. But the trajectory for what the Anabaptists had become was set 500 years ago. It was almost inevitable, based on what they did then, when their mentality and their priorities were established. And that's what, if you look at their history, you see that. You see where they're bound to lead based on what they did then. But this was only a portion of the early Anabaptists. So that is what I want to start covering right now. I want you to see how diverse they were initially, how that junk drawer label applies. I thought we would get to this sooner, but nevertheless, here we are. The Anabaptists were mainly in the Swiss cantons. They were in Germany. They were in Central and Eastern Europe a little bit. Later, Anabaptism arose in the Netherlands because some traveled there for refuge. They had more Christian liberty there, or at least church liberty. Some of the first true Anabaptists were actually under Zwingli in Zurich in the mid-1520s, and they were known as the Swiss Brethren, though there were some other fanatical Anabaptists in Germany that Luther had to deal with a little bit before them, but these guys are sort of the first true Anabaptists. The Swiss Brethren had three main figures: Felix Manz, Conrad Grebel, and George Blaurock. I have the most sympathy with these guys. Of all the Anabaptists, I have the most sympathy with these guys. They were in Zurich. They were reforming right along with Zwingli and the rest of Zurich. So they're presumably improving fairly quickly. They've come out of Roman Catholicism's air. They're starting to go back to the Bible. They're starting to reform. So you think, okay, these guys are making progress. And their reform started fairly simply. These were these guys were the Biblicist reformers, the Biblicist Anabaptists. They were practicing sola scriptura, just like Zwingli had taught them, which was, he said, if the New Testament doesn't teach it, we shouldn't practice it. Simple principle. So with Zwingli, they get rid of church images, they get rid of the church organ, they get things of that nature. They start to just strip out all this stuff. But after a few years, baptism came up. And when they raised that question of why are we practicing infant baptism if it's clearly not in the New Testament, then it became an issue. And it was initially received by Zwingli somewhat positively. He didn't just react super negatively at first. He seemed to somewhat be open to discussion. But the tradition was too strong. Infant baptism was tied to becoming a citizen of the state. You're kind of circumventing secular authorities if you don't practice infant baptism, which automatically makes them think, okay, these guys, they want anarchy, almost. Eventually, Zwingli opposes them, and then he's basically uncomfortable with the speed at which they were seeking to abandon the practice. That seemed to be the trigger that made him be like, all right, I'm not with you. I'm against you. So there were public disputations. Zwingli argues against them. The city council sides with Zwingli against the Swiss Brethren. But they start practicing credo baptism anyway. They're not doing immersion yet, but adult. They think of it in terms of adult baptism, which is considered by Zwingli as anabaptism, meaning baptism again, or rebaptism. That's what ana means. Again baptism. Hence that name, Anabaptist. So Zwingli asked the city, town council, or whatever, to pass ordinances against them, eventually even authorizing execution for convicted Anabaptists. At least that was permissible. It wasn't required, but it could go that far. It was probably just to drive them out or get them to stop, but once the Anabaptists stuck to their convictions, then some of these executions had to actually be done. And this, of course, is a consequence of sacralism, having a state church. So then and there, the violent and suppression and persecution of Anabaptism begun. It kind of started in Germany with these other guys, but it's just a little bit different brand. So Conrad Grebel left to preach in the surrounding areas. He got arrested, but escaped after a few months. However, soon after that, he got the plague and he died in 1526. Felix Manz was the first one martyred in January 1527. So this all happened fairly quickly. He received what was sadistically called a third baptism, which was being drowned in the river. They tied his hands together behind his knees, and then they'd stick a pole between him so that he could be held under the water, and then they could retrieve his body when he was done dying, while his brother and his mother looked on from the shore. That same day, George Blaurock was severely beaten and permanently expelled from Zurich. I think this is because Manz had a daughter he refused to get baptized or something. I'm not super clear on why one is banished and one is killed. But there's some leeway with the you know, secular authorities on how to handle it. So Blaurock's beaten. He's permanently expelled from Zurich. He was rearrested and rebanished multiple times in the following months. In 1529, so there's a few years where we're not real sure what he's doing, but he became a pastor in 1529 of a church whose previous pastor had been burned at the stake. Sadly, later that year, Blaurock, too, was arrested, tortured, and burned at the stake by Roman Catholic authorities. It's hard to feel anything but sympathy for these three Swiss brethren. They were different. They were different from a lot of the other Anabaptists, but also from the Reformers. There's no real great heresy on record from any of them. It's hard not to feel sympathy for them. How useful to the church would they have been, had they been given the freedom to mature in their reforming faith? If Zwingli had taken them under his wing and defended them and given them some liberty and taught them, would they have developed into Reformed Baptists? They could have, maybe. Would a Puritan-like movement had begun in Zurich and spread throughout Europe? Possibly. How grounded were they in the rest of the Reformed faith that they had been learning? They were in process of it. Did they abandon it or react against it because it was the faith of their persecutors? How strongly did they teach justification by faith alone? Why didn't that teaching come to undergird Anabaptist doctrine like it did with the Protestants? These are all historical, hypothetical questions I would love to have answered. The strange thing to imagine is that in eternity, when we get to ask them, we may very well find them side by side with their killers. Could happen. Restored in perfect union. These three men also seem to have association with another important early Anabaptist, Michael Sattler. He was a former monk who had briefly visited Zurich after he left his German monastery in 1525. Again, very short period of time. Left in 1525, and these guys were dead mostly by 1526, 1527. But he is Michael Sattler is best known for writing the Schleitenheim Confession in 1527. It's one of the very few confessional documents of the Anabaptists. We're going to talk about it tomorrow. It's not actually a full confession. We're going to talk about why that is. His life of being an Anabaptist was short, though. He left his monastery to come to Zurich in 1525, right as the Swiss brethren are kind of coming online as Anabaptists. But by he got expelled from there, and then by 1527, just 2 short years later, he, too, was captured by Roman Catholic authorities in Austria. At his trial, he was asked to be shown his heir from the scriptures. Reasonable, you would think. He was told the hangman would debate with him. Some of the soldiers guarding him mocked him while they were waiting for his verdict to be returned from the judges. And it was. It was returned in about an hour and a half. And it read this. This is the verdict. Michael Sattler shall be committed to the executioner. The latter shall take him to the square and there first cut out his tongue. Then forge him fast to a wagon. And there, with glowing iron tongs, twice tear pieces from his body. Then, on the way to the site of the execution, 5 times more, as above, and then burn his body to powder as an arch-heretic. The Roman Catholic Church did not mess around when it came to their executions. They exemplify horrific barbarity. There's a low-budget movie called The Radicals, which tells the story about Sattler and his wife, the early Anabaptists. If you're interested in watching it, I can send you a link. It's not super easy to find, but it's called The Radicals. So throughout this drawn-out execution where he's walking and being tortured and cut and torn with burning red tongs, Sattler reportedly preached to the watching crowds, even after having part of his tongue cut out. He asked the crowd to intercede for his judges. He asked the crowd to intercede for the judges who were there present, they were watching this. He addressed them directly, too. They tied him to a ladder to throw him into the fire, and just before he prayed, he said, "Almighty eternal God, thou art the way and the truth. Because I have not been shown to be in error, I will, with thy help on this day, testify to the truth and seal it with my blood." As he was burned, he prayed and he sang in the midst of the fire. And then after some time, the ropes that were binding his hands burned through, and he was able to raise his hands and give that famous two-finger sign of promise. And he finally prayed, "Father, I commend my spirit into thy hands." 2 days later, his wife was drowned, almost a compassionate execution in light of what they were capable of doing. So you can see that narrow window of time where all of this is happening. These men were the earliest recognized Anabaptists, starting in about 1525, and they were all dead in just a few short years. These guys are the best of the best. They're not indicative of the movement as a whole. They're the best of the best. In fact, if you study the early Anabaptists, you'll see a lot of death dates in those the latter half of the 1520s. A lot of them got killed. It's not even known what Sattler's beliefs were on the actual gospel. I'm not super sure where he was at. He was more of a holiness reformer. I don't know how to feel about him. I want to like him. But I'm not sure what he actually... I don't know how far he got away from his Roman Catholic roots. He barely had any time to get out of it. He wanted morality in the church. But morality doesn't save us. So again, like others, the specifics of his doctrine in regards to justification and salvation remain kind of ambiguous. And we're forced to leave it as an open question. His religious background and trial, they were all Roman Catholic. And though he denied enough of Roman Catholicism to be killed, he denied enough of transubstantiation or the authority of the Pope or whatever it may be, it's not clear if he reformed the heart of the air on the gospel. We're not real sure. I want to think that he did, but he maybe didn't. By the way, the Roman Catholic Church was responsible for 85% of Anabaptist executions, and the total number of Anabaptist deaths was dwarfed by the number who were killed from the Reformed. Absolutely dwarfed. But in terms of percentages, they were probably a little bit closer. So in many cases, the Anabaptists were technically charged with and executed for denying many of the same Roman Catholic doctrines that the Protestants were, but without being Protestant. And the fact that they were executed by so-called third baptism of drowning shows that there was this genuine hatred and this sadistic attitude towards them. It's almost like boiling a goat in its mother's milk. You're not supposed to do that. There's just something really twisted about it. And that's sort of what they're doing. At their executions, there was not exactly this begrudging sadness that these guys had to be done away with. They hated them. They hated them. We might also note that since their third baptism drowned them, it killed them, it shows that everyone really knew that baptizo meant to immerse. They weren't sprinkling Anabaptists to death at their third baptism. And don't get the impression that the Reformed were out hunting them down. Of all the groups, the Reformed killed them the least. Anabaptists could often survive fine, keeping a low profile in most cities. Their presence was known, but when a popular leader or a rabble-rouser showed up, they would often be challenged to a public disputation and then banished. They'd be kicked out. Hans Denck, for example, was this mystical Anabaptist. He denied justification by faith alone. He became a universalist. He had this public disputation with Martin Bucer in Strasbourg before being banished. He wasn't killed. He was just banished. Before his death from poor health, He was taken in Basel by Oecolampadius, the scholarly reformer, who visited him multiple times and interacted with him on doctrine. Another Anabaptist, Pilgrim Marpeck, was likewise challenged and banished, but otherwise treated fairly. He requested and was granted additional time to get his house in order before he left the city. And then he was replaced in his civil role by two suspected Anabaptists who were tolerated because they were just more private in their convictions. So you can see that the Reformed weren't out headhunting Anabaptists. They seemed to be open to frequent disputations with them, and they recognized the confusion of the period. So don't think it's just these big bully Reformed beating up on. I mean, it is a little bit. But there's some understanding there. Even after Marpeck left Reformed Strasbourg, he lived his final 12 years of life peacefully in Lutheran Augsburg, where he even worked for the city as a civil engineer, and they knew he was an Anabaptist. The authorities were kind of annoyed by his Anabaptist views, but they never really did anything about it. That sort of restraint was not practiced by the Roman Catholic Church, as we have heard. They were already well accustomed to the murder of the saints. They had renewed the Swabian League, who was this band of hundreds of armed horsemen. They were authorized to go kill Anabaptists without trial, just find them and kill them. And that's what they did. They killed men, women, and children even. But remember, being victimized or abused does not by default make you a good guy. I wish our culture understood this.
Amen.
Jews have for years been persecuted and martyred. You look at their religious resume, it's horrific what's happened to them. But they hate Jesus Christ. They're not good guys. Anabaptists aren't good guys just because they stand up for their convictions. Convictions are great. Being steadfast is great. But if you're doing it without the truth, you are a fool. And that's often what happened. Being steadfast is great. But if you're doing that by wild teaching, justification by faith alone is not true, that you're justified by faith plus works, you're still a heretic. You might be an oppressed heretic because you deny some element of the Roman Catholic Church, but you're still a heretic. Being a martyr does not save you. Faith in Christ alone saves you. And that's really the question of where they were with that. Did they get there? So those are the best of the best. Tomorrow morning, we're going to talk about the worst of the worst. I hope that wasn't too fast. But you can see, this picture of them is incomplete. It's going to get very ugly. In fact, I'm going to give the disclaimer now. The information you're going to hear tomorrow might not be appropriate for children. It gets explicit, both sexually and violently. And to get a full picture of that, we've got to talk about those details. So that's where we'll go tomorrow. Hope to see you then. And I hope that is a good beginning to what the Anabaptists were like.